Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the HR Cartel podcast. I'm your host, Tim Dive. Thank you for joining me once more. We've got a guest today, Josh from McClellan Hill Group of Companies, which we'll get stuck into. But first off, we kicked off our conversation a bit early. We've been talking about robots and all sorts of shit. So and very interesting things. We're talking about agriculture and how there's about 200,000 jobs vacant in that industry and we need those filled just to be able to feed ourselves. Then we got talking about AI and robots, BMW factories and what they're getting themselves into these days. And you know a fair bit, I think. So let's pick that conversation back up because we kind of paused on that to hit
realize we weren't recording. Yeah. So the most recent thing we were talking about is how BMW's already put in an order for these. I think they're ChatGPT is what's kind of running the interface, but I don't know. And I know that there's NVIDIA GPUs running the robots. But apparently the robotic company only started like 18 months ago and they've already, surpassed and bypassed like Boston Robotics and all of those crazy things, those little dogs we've been seeing for the last like 5 years. So it seems like, kind of the infusion of AI and robotics is making it, you know, jump leaps and bounds, probably because they have these things writing their own code and learning from themselves and kind of making micro adjustments as they go.
Yeah. Cause we're talking about that sort of technology in manufacturing, which led us into that conversation as well. And then we was talking about the $100 million equipment that's on farms these days out in outback Australia, if you can call it that, with that much technology, you know, and no one around with the skills or licenses to operate these sort of things. And talking about that technology has to be deployed because we're not going to fill 200,000 jobs in agriculture. And you said you got robots now basically going up and down yards, essentially zapping weeds with fucking lasers and all sorts of things. So that's ridiculous. I guess we'll give a bit of an intro to you because I described you to someone as a bit of a genuine entrepreneur. What I meant by that was, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, yeah, listening to your talk, it's almost like you started off a business you might have had some interest in, and then you thought, shit, I need some accounting to be done. I know what I'll do. I'll start a fucking accounting company. I'll sell the services and get my accounting number free. And it's like, oh, hang on, I need a website. Maybe I'll start a website company. And is that kind of how you've taken an approach to setting up your companies? And
Yeah, I think the concept has been brewing for, you know, probably a decade or more now as far as having a group of companies that all feed off of each other. So it was kind of the initial plan and just kind of had that in the back of our heads as we moved forward. Normally inside of a company, and this is similar to what you've created with your HR company as well, but normally with inside of a company, each of your departments are more or less just expense centers. You know, they just kind of feed off of the revenue and become an operating expense, in your overheads. And so especially because there's no accountability, you know, when you run a business, you kind of have a profit and loss and you got to make sure that you're profitable and you watch your expenses and you keep an eye on things. But when you just operate as a department on your own, there's none of that thought process or accountability that goes into it. So by kind of making them their own entities, even if they are only in the beginning servicing, you know, the other internal departments or businesses, it forces them to have accountability around what they're spending, whether they're profitable, whether projects are worthwhile, doing budgets, doing quotes, you know, and all that kind of stuff, rather than just sitting there and feeding off of it and then trying to attract efficiency from the top down.
Yeah, that's good because you're basically in building the development of commercial capability with that model, aren't you? And that's one thing that I know a lot of our clients struggle with when you're trying to, you know, to find good people these days. It's really difficult. There's so many things that you're up against. Firstly, the cost of employees trying to come up with with enough money and stuff to attract good people in, retain good people, give them development opportunities and that sort of thing. And that's one thing we talk about a lot where we try to design this way to develop commercial understanding for future leaders of the business, whoever's going to be the future CEO or MD or whatever it is that got going on for you.
Yeah.
Do you think that's naturally happening with your group?
Yeah, definitely. And it allows everybody to stay in their lane as well. So it's like, you know, when you need decisions around tax planning and CFO and budget, you know, and cash flow forecasting and all that kind of stuff. It's like, well, we have the experts that do that, that get paid for that. And they stay very sharp and honed because they're not only doing your stuff, they're doing, you know, a whole bunch of different industries and things like that. So they're required, instead of getting kind of that tunnel vision or that, that silo effect where they only know your industry and your product and they get kind of lost in the weeds in there. And so for the accountants, they get that stuff. If we need things automated or software, that goes to the software guys. If we need, you know, marketing or website stuff, that goes to the other team. And, you know, because they're forced to stay current in the marketplace, they always have to be, you know, adapting their skill sets and developing and learning the kind of like the latest and greatest technologies, instead of just kind of getting stuck in our pond and then slowly, you know, kind of becoming out of date.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing that I've said a lot about this profession that I'm in, this HR profession that I'm in. You know, the big end of town runs how HR functions and works and how it's valued. And what I mean by that is, they're the ones paying the highest salaries.
Yep.
They're the ones with the biggest HR teams. They're the ones with all the fragmented and split up profession of HR that provide HR professionals with a more diverse pathway for their career and more earning potential. It's all happening in big tier one operators, all that.
Yep.
But the byproduct of that is the silo that you talk about. You know, it's that they become experts of how things operate in four walls, and that's
yep.
it.
Yep.
And they stay there for however long that they want to do, and they'll leave there for a better opportunity, but it's the same silo.
100%.
And you try and then become a consultant from there and go to consult to smaller businesses who are just pounded by so many influential hits in their market, their commercial markets. They've got no commercial understanding of how businesses operate because of that silo effect. And this is why people hate HR. Price, no, because they come in with this big business mindset and throw this, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion agendas and all sort of stuff. And that, you know, you can talk about that stuff in big businesses, but take that to middle Australia, small, medium sized employers that have real risks every day.
Yep.
It's just lost on them. It's not relevant at all. So I think it's a good point you raised there.
Yeah, it's funny actually, because it's working in our benefit, because it's actually keeping, instead of having one company with a lot of employees in multiple departments, we now have multiple companies and businesses with a small amount of employees. And so it actually keeps us in the small business arm of Australia as well, which has a lot of benefits in all of those kind of compliance mandates coming down from the government, because generally they kind of leave you alone if you're under a certain amount of employees, because thank God they understand that all that red tape is, you know, costs you a fortune. And this is why businesses really have no incentive to grow in Australia, because you have the opportunity as a small business to have a fairly good lifestyle and make a fair amount of money from a profit margin standpoint and kind of, live a fairly cruisy life. But if you have a good product that's in demand, then there's your phone ringing off of the hook and you have people kind of chasing you up. And then, but the issue is that whole middle medium sized business ground is where your expenses grow exponentially, but your revenue really kind of stays the same. So you watch your profit margin drop from 50% to 40% to 30% to 18%. And it's not until you can scale that and become kind of a large nationwide company that you really start to reap the benefits of that. But you have all that pain and suffering. You get a big target on your back from the ATO and from, you know, ASICs and from ACCC and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, it's getting to the place to where it's well and truly not worth it. You're better off kind of staying small and operating as almost a sole trader with maybe a few contractors, employees, versus, you know, getting, it's not until you get up to, you know, 80 plus employees to where you really can start to, and, you know, the headaches that go along with that, obviously, if you don't have middle management set up properly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you've got, even that journey from zero to 80 employees, so much change happens in there, and so much learning, so much technology gets created, systems get created. You learn, you know, how you operate with five employees is not how you service customers with 20 and 30.
Exactly.
And you've got to continue that learning all along, and so much change happens. You mentioned a couple of things there that are interesting. I won't mention his company, but you and I heard this comment made by someone who's the head of a very, very large construction company in Australia. And we won't throw them under the bus because they're not here to defend themselves or explain themselves better. But The comment that I remember from that conversation, this, bear in mind, this is an enormous business, very yeah. successful Australian company, been around for more than 100 years. You might be able to figure who I'm talking about without explanation. But the head of this business said, don't grow.
Yeah.
Don't fucking do it to yourself. He's like, he was adamant, do not get big. You don't need to. And it's just bigger is not necessarily better.
Yeah.
The growth isn't necessarily worth it.
Mm.
And that probably shocked a lot of us listening to that, with someone who's the head of a large business like that. But I reckon what you're saying there, let's magnify those sort of issues you just raised then by a million and try to be the guy that has to answer the fucking phone every day with those problems going on.
Yep.
Like
2,500 employees or however many it is. It's
Yeah, nuts. And that leads me to another question. If you can't tell by the accent, you're not from around here.
Mm.
But you have been here for a while, right?
Yeah, 10 years.
Can you compare the legislative or compliance frameworks and obligations between here and the States? Is it a stark difference?
Oh, yeah, it's massive. I always tell people, you know, if you want to run a business, then the US is the promised land. And if you want to be an employee, then Australia is the promised land. Oddly enough, I've moved to Australia and run businesses, but we do have offices in the US and things of that nature. But the US is probably our largest region for our e-commerce side of the business, just because of the sheer size of the marketplace there. But yeah, it's there's an understanding of free market capitalism in the US, and obviously there's, you know, between Democrats and Republicans, similar here to like Labor and Conservative or whatever, there's kind of different viewpoints on the way that should be rolled out. You know, if the US system and the Australian system probably had a baby and merged into a single thing, then it would be really kind of center of the road. Australia has gone extraordinarily heavy on focusing on employees' rights, and unions are still around, and kind of pushing that whole side of it, whereas the US focuses on the employer and realizes that they're the ones that actually create the jobs and give a lot of the benefits to the business owners and that. So you did generally in the US see a disservice, I guess, from especially from an Australian standpoint, looking in from the outside in to the employees. But what they don't realize is, yeah, minimum wage is $7, $8, whatever it may be. Waiters and waitresses only made $2.13 an hour plus tips. But I was in that industry. I worked in restaurants for 5 years. I worked in hospitality. I worked in administrative offices and all kinds of things. And, you know, everything in the U.S. was so cheap. But the reason it was so cheap is because labor was so cheap. So you can create products and you can go out and get a full meal for, you know, $12, and you're going to take home a doggy bag of a whole nother meal that you get to eat. So people are going out to eat three or four times a week. Restaurants are open till 11 o'clock at night because they're not paying their staff. You're paying their staff for them with tips. So it really was a beautiful kind of harmonious system. And now what a lot of people don't realize is like, all right, well, we need to raise minimum wage. We need to give more money, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, all right, well, you can do that, but the business owners aren't going to take the hit. They're going to pass that expense along to the consumer, which means your retail prices are going to go up.
Yeah.
So everyone can go from $8 an hour to $15 an hour to $20 an hour minimum wage, but it just means that your loaf of bread's going to go from $2 to $4. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it's just inflation almost to a degree. It's, you know, cost of living is going to go up in accordance. So from a quality of life standpoint, that is the kind of major difference, I guess, between the US and Australia from a quality of life standpoint. Is in the US, even though everybody was more fairly middle class, nobody has kind of like savings. Everybody's kind of like hand to mouth. They got a couple weeks probably of money in the bank, and we don't go on international trips to Bali every year. And, you know, you'll talk to most people in the US, they've never been outside the US. And that's one of the reasons why is we only get 2 weeks paid leave, and then we don't have any savings to travel anyways, even if we wanted to. But it does really encourage growth from an economic standpoint, and that's why it was always called like the American dream or the land of freedom, because if you had $25, you could go down to city, you know, town hall and get a business license, and you're off to the races. Whereas over here it's like, you know, $600 to create a company, and then you've got, you know, all of your compliance and legislation. I mean, if small businesses in Australia actually crossed their T's and dotted their I's as far as the legislation requirements around insurance and around, you know, everything else that's involved, I don't think it would actually be possible to start a business unless you had at least $250,000 startup capital, which obviously most people that are turning a hobby into a, you know, a business or an idea out of their garage or whatever have you, they don't have that ability. And so you really force people to kind of go around the system for quite a while until they get to a certain size to where they can actually afford it.
Yeah, it's kind of necessary, isn't it?
And then you start realizing, oh, well, if I'm going to get the right business insurance and get the right this and get the right that and, you know, HR and all the other kind of stuff, it's like, it's not really profitable for me to expand, which kind of circles back around to what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you raised a couple of points there that relate to some conversations I've been having as well with, you know, the rise in wages. You've got an explanation I gave to India, our HR associate here, who came from New Zealand, who's a graduate, who's learning the Australian business systems and frameworks and legislation and all sort of stuff. And to explain to someone who's not from here and who's new to how things work, it's quite alarming for someone to hear, you know, the politics at play. How one side of politics gets out of the way of business, the other side gets right in the business and gives all the money to employees, and where that money then gets given to unions through higher membership fees or force fees and superannuation payments, and where that money goes, and how the construction industry gets tied into it, and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
And you're right, everything gets jacked up. The cost of everything gets jacked up. I was talking to a business owner just this week, actually, who had the suggestion that, look, maybe we should raise salaries for the salespeople. Now, every business relies on sales unless you work for the government. And if you work for the government, you don't belong in this conversation, really, frankly, about commercial success and things, because you've got no customer, right? You've got no competition.
It's free money. You don't have to raise money. You don't have to. It's not revenue for you.
Yeah. And so what we've seen in sales focus roles is, you know, the higher and more professional type of salesperson, it used to be that don't pay me anything, give me commission only, give me all the benefits, I remember, because I was in a sales focus job back in a long time ago, you know. I think all of us have probably worked in some sort of sales focus job now at some point in our lives, but the guns out there, the awesome operators in sales, but don't pay me a cent, give me just commission. And there's ways you can do that lawfully. It's highly illegal to pay someone nothing, but you can model commission structures and frameworks to be able to do that. Now we're seeing in numerous of our clients, we've got about 56 companies we work with, on varying levels, but we're seeing those types of professionals now, they're demanding 110-120k base salaries before they even sold anything, right?
Crazy.
So what happens now is, okay, well, you're gonna sell threefold what you cost me before you get a set of commission. So they're just changing it around a little bit, you know, before you get paid almost next to nothing as a base salary, but you're getting commission off the bat right away and making big dollars. So that effect is real. It's happening right now, and cost of living does. It's a vicious circle, you know.
Yeah, I guess because then the more expensive everything becomes, the less risk people are willing to take, just because of the associated, you know, risk that comes along with having that that unknown source of income. You know, back in the day, if you wanted to take a sales job and it was commission only, then you'd generally give it a stab. You know, if you thought you were a good salesperson, you'd give it a crack, because the benefit, you know, I guess as far as what you could make from a commission standpoint outweighed the risk of potentially I go in for a couple of weeks, don't make any sales. We're facing this with one of our businesses that sells commercial kitchen equipment. We've kind of expanded into the place now where we need kind of business development people out on the ground and actually going out and doing sales and talking to people. But we've had this exact same conversation in the last couple of months where it's like, well, this person, we could pay this person a lot of money if they succeeded and if they did good, but we haven't even ever ventured into that. So we really have a lot of trial and error to work out unless we bring somebody in that's quite seasoned in that field and they kind of know how to hit the ground running with it. But for us, from a risk association standpoint, we would love to take somebody on and say, you know, here's the amazing amount of money you can make, and we're pretty positive that you're going to be able to do it, but we don't have the ability or desire, I guess, in a sense, to take somebody, like you said, and bring them on at 120K and hope for the best.
Yeah, big risk.
Big risk. Mm. Could be, you know. And it's sad to say that somebody that comes in and is purely sales-driven as far as their actual job description, even on 120K, if they start making sales and bringing in revenue for the company, they won't be satisfied because they'll know that they are the clinch pin that is actually bringing that revenue into the company. So they're going to want a slice of the pie, even though you as a business owner took the risk. And this is the breakdown that you see because people have grown up in Australia with a government that is so benefit focused from an employee standpoint. People have a subconscious kind of thought pattern in Australia that jobs are, you know, a right. They're not entitlement. Like a privilege. Yeah. There's this entitlement. And because the government has three safety nets, you know, that you can fall back on if you lose your job or anything else, then yeah, there's an entitlement that has been lost that we had in previous generations where, you know, going out and working for your family and bringing in an income and all that kind of stuff was not something that was just a birthright. That you actually had to be a good employee, that you actually had to show up on time, that you had to have good moral focus and compass, and that you actually had to put in the extra work in a sense. And now there's all of this, you know, government oversight and government stuff that's coming in to kind of like enforce all of that, which was always like unspoken policy. And it was always just whether you're a good human being or not. Like if your boss is a dick and you don't like the environment and it's toxic, then you quit and go somewhere else. It's like if you buy a product off the shelf and you don't like the taste of it, you just don't buy it again. So supply and demand and that free capital marketplace that I talked about kind of when I was comparing it to the US, we treat jobs and employment in the US similar to the way that you treat, you know, businesses and consumers and products and consumers and things. And it's all based, you know, it's like how you vote with your dollar, right? Wherever you put your money is where you're voting in a sense when it comes to that. And same thing with employment. If there's a toxic place that's not good to work at, then that's what that business owner is offering the marketplace. And if demand is really high and supply is low, then he may get workers and employees because there's no other options. But in that same token, if he has a really hard time getting employees and keeping them, then he's either going to go out of business or he needs to, you know, change his tune and change his policies, get an HR company involved, whatever he needs to do. And so really everything kind of works itself out.
It's supposed to, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is my problem with overreaching governments, you know, because they interfere and they don't know what's best.
And they mess up the balance.
Yeah, absolutely they do, yeah.
You're bailing out a company that's gone under. Well, there's probably a reason the company went under. It's the reason 2008 when all the banks got bailed out and then, you know, nobody went to jail and they all got a slap on the wrist. And we're seeing the same house of cards being built up in the economy right now with what happened during COVID and all the rest of it. And it's like when the government steps in and stops the organic evolution of what's supposed to take place on its own from happening, then you upset the whole apple cart. And the small little collapses that we're supposed to get throughout industries and throughout sectors and throughout, you know, the economy and all that get propped up. Mm. And then when we do get a collapse, it's catastrophic.
It's much bigger than it needs to be. Yeah. And it should have happened at a lower level. Yeah. They're good points you raised there. Let me ask you this. Before that question, I think what you're saying here is, and this is something that if people have listened to this podcast before or work with me, I'm heavily about, well, the customer decides.
Yeah.
Right. Customer always decides. If the customer wants to work with you, they're going to work with you when you're a good business, and then you're going to have resources available to retain and attract good employees and put development in place and all that sort of stuff. It's all about commercial customer markets. And that's people, right?
Yeah.
What do people actually want? when the government comes in and forces companies to operate in a certain way,
yep.
bear in mind, these are groups of people who have no real, let's say, I won't say no commercial or private industry experience, but very few of them have any.
Correct. Yeah.
These days, you can go to uni and study politics and come out and be a career politician for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
You don't have to have any commercial experience whatsoever. You're now making rules of how businesses in competitive commercial markets have to operate and what they have to pay. Your price fixing wages, where if the businesses did that, they go to jail.
Yep.
Directors would go to jail.
True.
You know. It's illegal, but they can do it, right? Yeah. And they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what's best. And that does fuck things up. It really does. What I was going to ask you, the question was, as an employer, knowing, you know, how much change we've gone through with industrial relations laws and things in the last 18 months, not just the last 18 months, but the last 5 years, you know, both governments too, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, From the mouth of an employer with businesses in multiple businesses in competitive markets, does this turn you off from wanting to employ?
Oh yeah, 100%. I say quite often that if it wasn't for the entrepreneurial spirit, so there's two things that keeps the Australian economy alive: the pride of the people, as far as like, I don't want a boss, I don't like somebody to tell me what to do, so I want to work for myself. So you get a lot of those businesses that exist, and then you get the entrepreneurial spirit, which is people that want to build and they want to chart new territory, and they want to find a missing link in the system, in the marketplace, where there's a demand for a product and nobody's filling that, whether it's service or whether it's whatever it may be, and they find you know, enjoyment in their gifting just by creating something and inserting it there. And so if it wasn't for those things, and generally more the entrepreneurial standpoint, because a lot of the businesses that are built on the back of somebody that just doesn't, you know, work well with being told what to do, don't generally thrive and expand that well. But yeah, if it wasn't for the entrepreneurial spirit, there's zero incentive. You take all of the risk. You're the first one in, the last one out. You're, you know, have the burden of taking all of the compliance targets and, you know, having yourself put in the target as far as sued and, you know, going to jail and, you know, taxes. And I mean, if it, you know, between super and BAS and PAYG and GST and, you know, income tax and sales tax and, you know, there's just so much. And there's really no reason, especially when wages are so good in Australia, you know, if I can go, you know, take a course and get a ticket on something and go make, you know, $50 or $60 an hour and clock in and clock out and not take any of that burden home with me, then I'm going to be so much better off, just from a quality of life standpoint. You know,
well, you can do a 2-day course and get a traffic control ticket in Queensland. You're taking home $200,000 a year.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
it's because of the health and safety. It just boggles my mind. So what's one of the benefits, you know, right? People, just Aussies look at the US and they say, you guys don't have a healthcare system. It's insane. Obviously, I grew up in it, so it doesn't seem that crazy. But I do understand now, living here for 10 years, looking at it, how absurd it is. But then you look at the equal and opposite reaction of having a healthcare system where the government is fitting the bills for everything, even though you're supposed to be paying for it out of your taxes, because they want that tax money for other things. The whole health and safety industry is propped up and becomes a $1 trillion industry because they want, you know, it's the reason a seatbelt fine's $400, which should be your choice whether you put a seatbelt on or not. It's you going to be you flying through the windshield. It's not, it doesn't affect them, but see, it does affect them. In the US, you get a $25 ticket for not wearing a seatbelt, because if you go through the windshield, it's coming out of your pocket, not coming out of theirs. But the government, oddly enough, thinks about the money in their pocket as their money. And so you get these pros and cons of having these nanny kind of state systems where there's that kind of oversight or that protection in place. And then you get, you know, like I said, that equal and opposite reaction where the government's kind of like, so that the entire health and safety, you know, you get one guy using the whippersnipper or whatever, and he's on the other side of the metal guard on the highway, and there's like 17 trucks in 3 lanes shut off. And I'm like, The taxpayers are paying $6,000 an hour for some dude to mow the grass on the other side of the highway.
Yeah.
You never see that in a million years. Yeah. So it's just, there's some guy that gets paid $80 an hour to walk around and stare at your front door and be like, yep, it's still there, because he's there to make sure that your fire door is still. And it's just, so it's gone way overboard, and there's all of these entities that exist, that really shouldn't be, or if they should, it's just because of unions and whatever else. It's just gone way overboard.
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying when I was explaining to Indy, our associate from NZ, about how the system works.
Yep. It's,
I won't go into it now because it's a whole episode, right?
It's a rabbit trail.
It needs to fucking whiteboard behind me to draw it all out to make sense of it all. Different groups will lobby the government and control the government by giving them money. So, for example, let's take the union movement, who funds the Labor Party with millions of dollars to get elected, for example. There's payback for that investment.
Yep.
Right? The government, and everyone knows this, right? It's out in the open. There's a guy called John Secker from the CFMEU, and he's quite vocal about it, stands on a podium with TV cameras on him saying the government will pay us back or we'll bury them, So it's out in the open.
Yeah.
Which stuns me as well. If the other side of politics did that, this isn't a political podcast, by the way, just IR lends itself to it, right? We have to talk about it. But if the other side of politics did that with the business community, it'd be corruption.
Exactly.
Right. It is corruption. We know that. But the payback isn't a transfer of money, a direct transfer of money.
Mm.
The union will bang on about things like safety, for example. And what they're doing is they're pushing the government to make laws that mandate certain things that have to be completed in building inspections and whippersnippers that need three lanes closed off.
Yep.
That creates this job and that traffic controller and this person wearing a vest and all these things. Now, all those people are getting paid money.
Yeah.
The union then puts agreements in place with governments, as we have here in Queensland right now. You must have an agreement with the CFMEU. Don't quote me on that, but it's something like that.
Yeah.
In order to get on those projects, they control what jobs get invented.
Mm.
They get the union fees. They get the superannuation payments into their superannuation companies. So that's the transfer of money, right? People ask me all the time, well, why are unions so bad? Why do they even do this shit? Well, it takes me ages to explain to you why, but that's one of the reasons. It's the lobbying of the government to create industries and prop up industries like construction or whatever else.
The mafia, the way the mafia operated in the US really is where unions were birthed out of.
Exactly, yeah.
It's really no different, minus it being legal versus illegal behind the scenes as far as out in the open. But it's all the same. It's all the same, like, incentives. Even the way that things work as far as all the lobbying and all of
the control of leverage. Resources.
Yeah.
The control of resources. And we're seeing this now with the manufacturing union in New South Wales, that they've struck up the first multi-employer deal, single interest enterprise bargaining agreement, which is a new feature of Australian workplace relations, which came about last year. They got the first one done, I think. Inherent in that agreement, you read between the lines, it's, they call it, shared resources amongst the industry.
Yeah.
That's what they're calling it. So manufacturing company A has 100 manufacturing employees, but they can be shared with company B, C, D, and E, shared around.
Yep.
The union controls that agreement, right? It's a union agreement.
Yep.
They control the labor.
Yep.
Now they're in control of the labor.
Yeah.
If you don't give them what they want in one business, they're gonna make sure you don't get that labor.
Correct.
They're controlling resources.
Yep.
That's a mafioso sort of approach.
It is, and they're their own worst enemy. And the people that are under those union umbrellas that feel like the union's there to protect them and serve them, is actually not the case. We saw this with Holden Manufacturing here in Australia. It's only so long that those unions will squeeze every little last bit of juice of profit out of the feeding arms and the businesses that they are, quote unquote, servicing, before those businesses will either shut down or they'll go overseas. And so really they are not this savior that they make themselves out to be, because at the end of the day, they're actually killing the economy that creates that wealth and creates those jobs. You know, I would hear horror stories about like, oh, you know, there was a downed manufacturing line at the Holden plant, and it was a Thursday, and, you know, they would do these things and do all this stuff to make sure that like the staff couldn't come back on a Friday so that everybody got a long weekend and this and that. And, you know, if you work on a Sunday, it's, you know, X, Y, Z amount of money and all. And there's just, they just trap the business and choke the life out of them until the business has no incentive or no profit to even be sustainable to operate. And then there's no jobs for anyone. Yeah. But then, you know, the way the union sees it is just on to the next business. But there's, you know, it's not a large population. There's only 20 million people, and there's only so many people that are willing to run businesses with zero incentive. And so eventually the unions will just slowly go around and just kill the industries.
That's right. And this is, that's a good point you raised there too, because this is the point that I've tried to explain as best I can in recent times. There's a couple of examples I'll give you in relation to what you just said. The first is, you know, same job, same pay legislation that came out is when, you know, the cost of labor is so high with enterprise agreements. Yeah. And I've worked for a company called BHP Billiton in the past, and I've managed these agreements, and I've been in the room with the unions, and I've argued with them and all sorts of things, and they do control those sites. They control what's happening at that site. The union doesn't want you to do something at that site. They're going to tell 1,000 workers to sit down because the Milo tin's empty, right? That's what's going to happen,
100%.
Right? And so,
and when the Milo truck drives in to deliver the new Milo, and they're already walking out the door, they all run for it before the Milo. I've heard these stories.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, and they're going to do it, right? And now that's Labor who, not Labor government, but Labor workforce, who are under an enterprise agreement that is jacked up like you wouldn't believe. You know, we're talking about people working 5 months of the year, week on, week off, earning $130,000, $150,000 a year.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a very high expense, right? Naturally, this business in its commercial operations is going to have to try and weather that somehow, mitigate the risk of that cost of that labor.
Yep.
So they create their own, BHP created their own labor hire business, and it would share resources amongst its sites via the labor hire arrangements. Now, you know, that legislation that passed for that business alone, that one business alone, running coal mines in Queensland here, was going to cost them, I think they said something like $5.1 billion or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, who owns BHP Billiton? The mum and dad across the road, shareholders, Australian shareholders, mostly superannuation is invested in BHP Billiton, all sorts of stuff, right? So the union will say, well, fuck BHP, you know, billionaires. And what they actually do is when there's enterprise bargaining agreement renegotiations happening on site, they create propaganda and marketing material and stick it in the lunchrooms. But they depict BHP Billiton as a big fat cat in a tuxedo, smoking a cigar, lighting it with a $100 bill.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
They will have you think that's who BHP Billiton
100%.
Is. No. You're BHP Billiton. Yep. Your super's in that company.
Yeah.
That's who the shareholders are. You know, of course there's some rich people in there. Yeah, there is. Fucking you are BHP, right?
I guarantee that rich person didn't flip and work 5 months of the year working 1 week on weekly
off. No, not at all. But what's happened now, and don't quote me on this because I am trying to remember an article that I read about BHP Billiton and decisions to sell off coal mines now, because it's just not worth it for them to operate anymore, right?
Yep.
They had a 50% joint venture with a Chinese company to run all these coal mines. So the risk of that is now we could potentially lose this to China.
Yeah.
This coal production to China.
Yeah.
There are bigger things at stake, but you're right. When you push a commercial operating business in a competitive commercial market to the brink of not being worth it anymore, they're out of here.
Correct.
They're gone. Whoever takes up that opportunity, if it's now, I've worked on Chinese projects where the Chinese Communist Party was a part of the ownership of the project.
Yep.
Australians aren't getting those jobs, mate.
Correct.
They're not getting them.
And right? The money's not getting recirculated back into this economy. It's going offshore.
Don't even think it is. Yeah. like, and I'll name a project, the Sino Iron project over in WA. Anybody who was on that project building that project will know exactly what I'm talking about. And lots of people on that project. It was a very large iron ore magnetite project. Australians are not getting those jobs, and Australian contractors are not getting paid on those jobs either. Chinese government does not give a shit about your Fair Work Commission, let me tell you now. So that's a very real thing that happens, and you're right. When you push a company to the wall like that, they are exiting. They're out of here. It's detrimental for us. So there was another point I wanted to make there, but it's left me. It will come back to me at some point.
That's all good.
what I want to make sure we do, though, is talk about, you know, some context around what you do. If people listening to this episode are actually watching it, I'm going to share my screen now and show your website. Give a bit of info about your companies, because what I want to ask you. And we'll see in a second. Quite a diverse range of businesses, different markets, different skill sets. It's very different, right? I'm interested in how do you go about finding people to appoint to the leadership of those of those businesses, because that's in my world, I struggle to find someone who I can just have sit in the seat with me that I can trust and work with, and have them work with my clients. How the hell, I think to myself, how the hell would I do that with 5-6 different businesses? So I might share my screen if that's right with you. And you can talk a bit more about the companies, but that's what I wanted to ask you about, you know. So if you wouldn't mind sharing your thoughts on that. But McClellan Hill, we'll look at the different companies you got in play here. You can see the screen that I've got here.
So do you want me to take you through each
one? Give us a talk through it.
So commercial dehydrators, so that's Sean and I on the far right top photo there. Commercial dehydrators was the initial kind of company where me and him joined forces. My last name's Hill, his last name's McClellan. So that was providing commercial food dehydrators for businesses doing things like beef jerky, a lot of orchards and, you know, farmers and things of that. We generally deal with a lot of people that have a waste product that's just going in the bin, and then they realize they can kind of like dehydrate it somehow, way, shape, or form, and turn it into actually a really good extra revenue source, if not sometimes their main revenue source. So Sean had a cold-pressed almond milk company here on the Gold Coast, and one of the byproducts of making almond milk is all the almond pulp. Well, that was just either getting discarded or sold off really cheap. And, you know, turns out you can dehydrate that and mill it up and turn it into almond flour, which sells for a premium because it's a, you know, gluten-free alternative to flour, et cetera. So anyways, we started in Australia, then launched in the US and Canada, UK, New Zealand, et cetera. So that's kind of what the funding arm, I guess, was to start all these other entities. Bench Foods is the brand of the actual equipment. Now we've started bringing out food preparations, machines and slicers, strip tanks. We're kind of expanding sideways in other things that are applicable along with the dehydrators. Then you have Alphabyte software solutions. So they're mainly, they don't even have a website because we haven't needed one, because it turns out that there's a lot of companies out there that need custom integration software systems for their administrative tasks. The main thing that we used them for internally was to automate everything. There's so much inefficiencies in companies as far as people double handling or people just doing data entry, you know, a lot of monkey work that really can be set up. And if the logic is there for a human being to figure it out, then generally the logic can be programmed into a software where it says, I'm going to take this piece of information and put it in these three different places, which is going to notify these people they need to do X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
So that's the reason we were able to expand with such a minimal workforce. You know, our largest region in the US, which I don't know, does millions of dollars a year in revenue, is ran by, you know, a single like 21-year-old girl or something like that. And then we have pretty much a warehouse manager, and that's about it for the entire US. That's the only people that we have running that whole thing, because everything's automated. And then scrolling down, so then you have RMH Fabrication on the left hand side. So just I'll go over and then I'll talk about the people that run a company. So RMH Fabrication is metal fabrication. The initial idea around that was that we were wanting to, which brings us back to our other conversation, but we were wanting to manufacture our own dehydrators. So we started drop shipping dehydrators from China directly from a manufacturer across the world. And then we've worked throughout the years to create a hybrid model where we were swapping out the internal working parts for our own so that they were kind of like upgraded and would last longer. And now we do our own manufacturing from start to finish, have our own factories in China and stuff like that. But we were going to fabricate our own. And I got a 16 tray, which is our smallest units, kind of like the size of a mini fridge, sent to Australia, sent to a fabrication company down in Adelaide. And they told me they couldn't get the sheets of stainless steel, like the raw material, for the price that we had it folded, lasered, riveted, wired, PCB boards, packaging, shipped, received, customs, internal shipping. So our end actual price to get it to our warehouse in Australia as a full product was cheaper than what in Australia is from a fabrication standpoint you could buy the stainless steel sheets for.
Well,
yeah. And so it's like, you know, this is gets back to that whole debate of it's like, well, buy Australian made and you know, we need to cut China off and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, well, on paper, yeah, but we're well and truly past that point, you know, like unless the Australian consumer is willing to pay four times the price and not be able to afford to go to Bali every year, then you know, we are kind of the authors of our own fate in that sense. TrueSight's the accounting firm. So we have offices in Sunny Coast, Gold Coast, Toowoomba, Brisbane. And so we service businesses, medium to large scale businesses. One of the things that we're trying to roll out is a product where it's pretty much business suite. So say, for instance, you needed your accounting done and you needed you wanted kind of your compliance stuff around BAS. You wanted like a profit and loss report meeting done once a month, all that kind of stuff. Then we just set you up on a subscription. So you'd pretty much pay like maybe $400 a week. But then you never have to think about anything, you know, so instead of getting these big balloon payments at the end of the year for your tax returns or your quarterly, you know, BAS filing or your, whatever it may be, we kind of take the cost of it for a whole year and then we just spread it across. So it's, yeah. And so it's budgetable, you know, what's happening. So many companies get, invoices from accounting firms and they never know what it's going to be or how many hours are going to be on it. And so this just makes it budgetable from a cash flow standpoint. And it gives you an outsourced CFO that's, you know, an expert in everything and is going to get you your biggest tax return. So if anything, it's probably saving you money. It's probably actually, not costing you money. You're probably actually getting more money than you would if you had like an internal accountant or somebody doing your books. UX Flow is websites design very focused on kind of the user experience. Can do everything from we do huge e-commerce brands here in Australia, pretty much across all sectors, but it's very UX focused, which is based on like the actual user's experience throughout your website. App design, marketing through social media, Google Ads, all that kind of stuff. A lot of branding exercises. So Mark John Chef, which is the guy on the right hand side there, he's kind of a genius when it comes to like doing a day long brand workshop to figure out who your customers are, what, you know, who your competitors are in the industry, where you want to be placed in that whole field, and then creating a brand and a logo and a story to really personify that existence in the marketplace. And then, you know, does all the steps to fulfill that through the website and branding and stuff. Is there any other companies or is that it? Okay.
That's all that's listed. Yeah, okay. You've got more.
There probably is. Yeah.
and there's a lot there. This is what I mean. You know, and they're obviously quite different, standing on our own feet.
Yep.
You know, one of those businesses there, you said you got offices all over the place. So you obviously got a lot of customers coming through finding value in it. You know, how does that manifest from out of Josh's head to become that?
So, yeah, one of the things that we kind of specialize in, I guess from a McClellan Hill standpoint, is there's a lot of people out there that are kind of sole traders, or they may be running their own business, or they've been an expert in their field for 15 years and they're just kind of over it. They may have a lot of good ideas of what the marketplace needs or what all the pain points are in the marketplace and how to do it better. But there's a misunderstanding for people that aren't entrepreneurs and haven't been down the road, you know, 100 times themselves on that, you know, to start a business, you just need to pretty much go out on your own and start a business. They don't realize that there's all of the accounting and finance side that needs to be done, and the compliance side and the HR side. And you generally, as a sole trader, the revenue that's coming into the business is purely based off of your time. So you're sacrificing your time, you know, and you're selling that time to clients to bring in the revenue for the company. Well, that means that you need to continue to work 40 hours a week in order for the business to be sustainable. But it's not really a business. You're really just working for your paycheck. There's just no middleman business that's paying you from a paycheck. You're just kind of going directly to the client yourself. But you need to be able to not be working full time in order to grow the business, in order to brand the business, in order to market the business, in order to have meetings and do things that aren't directly selling your time to a client in order to expand that. And so pretty much what we do as McClellan Hill is we take the whole entity, all of the group of businesses, and we attach that to your skill set and your mission in life and your thing that you're bringing to the marketplace. And so we, you know, go hand in hand. And so what we do is we allow the engineer to continue to do what they know best and continue to bring their service to the marketplace. But then we prop them up and blow wind in their sails with, you know, capital injection. Generally in businesses, you need to go negative in order to go positive. So you'll reach these kind of plateaus and you're like, all right, well, I need to hire two more people to just do quoting all of the time because I don't actually have the time to be on the tools anymore to take on more clients. And it's like, all right, well, in order to do that, we're going to have to go negative temporarily because we're going to have to bring on extra expenses in order to bring on extra revenue. Mm-hmm. And generally as a sole trader, you never have that ability. A lot of the guys that we work with have, you know, families and kids and all the rest of it. And so they don't have the ability that maybe a young 21-year-old entrepreneur has, as far as I'm just going to work 16 hours a day and burn the candle at both ends and, you know, work a full-time job and build my business on the side. So yeah, what we do is we say, all right, well, we have the softwares and the systems and the know-how and the capability and the legal understandings and the accounting and the automations from a standpoint. And so we partner with those guys and, yeah, really just help them. The vision that they have for what the marketplace needs, we help them bring that into fruition. So we'll take UX flow and say, all right, branding exercise, brand logo, name, get the domains, create a website. What's our messaging to the public? All right, let's bring in now the marketing standpoint. All right, what are the systems need to be for onboarding clients? Can we automate that so that humans aren't involved but still give the customer a good experience? And we plug in Alphabyte, then we plug in the accounting side to make sure that everything's structured the way it should be and legally and, you know, all the rest of it. And so
you've got a full circle of resourced, skilled, capable people you put around an idea. Yep. And
they all pay each other. It's not like, it's interesting because the company itself, so say Alphabyte, for instance, when it starts off, it's actually invoicing, you know, Commercial Dehydrators and UX Flow and RMH, and it's charging those places. Now we have internal McClellan Hill rates, which are cheaper than what they would charge, you know, retail or public, but they're still making a profit margin. And so it's almost like a training wheels experience, because that director who's probably not used to running business in that degree, we get to work the kinks out with them and say, all right, there's a roadblock here. There's a hindrance here. Hey, that didn't go smoothly. Hey, we underquoted for that. And so before they ever even go to the public, they have all these other businesses internally and all this other grace to work through to be able to say, you know, now we're ready to actually go to the public and stuff like that.
Yeah. And that's exposure that they're not going to get. Yeah. And this is why I was interested in talking about how do you actually appoint people to lead and drive these things. And it's making more sense to me now. There's a system that I've designed, and I borrowed it from Silicon Valley, actually, with the way they do those types of businesses do capability development with future leaders and things. And I've rolled this through probably three or four different businesses now with some success too, where we'll take a high performer within one business.
Yep.
We'll take a high performer. That business might have 10 different departments. You know, you might have marketing, you might have BD, you might have operations, whatever, right?
Yep.
The way technology changes industries these days and the way the industries move so rapidly means you can't train people to lead these companies, right? You can't employ leaders.
Yep.
It's very, you can, right?
Mm.
But it's very hard to employ a person to lead an organization these days that doesn't need some kind of significant development or whatever help.
Yeah.
So the model we did was kind of it's akin to what you're doing, which is, right, let's identify the high performers with potential to be the future CEO of this big business, but not now, maybe 5, 6, 7 years from now.
Yep.
You're now in a special position. You're going to go to the partner and show the head of marketing, and you're going to sit there for 6 months, and they're going to give you marketing problems and projects to complete and propel the business forward.
Mm.
When you're done there, you're going to go work with the CFO, and they're going to give you projects and things to complete. And then when you're done there, you're going to the manufacturing guy, then the operations, or whatever it is, right?
Mm.
And after 2 or 3 years, and what you've got to do, though, is you've got to give these people incentives and to retain them and keep them in this program.
Yeah.
So there is some cost tied to it. But what you're doing is you're actually internally creating a monster, you know, this beast within your own system that understands intimately and has solved and created solutions for every single department along the way.
Yeah.
That's now going to come with the knowledge of how every department, what they value, what they need, what sort of people are in there, how they take information, how they deal with information.
Mm.
And we're trying to create the ultimate leader.
Yep.
It sounds like your system's doing that.
Yeah. And it does. They stay in their own lane, but they all feed off of each other as well. I mean, recently we were working with one of the pistol clubs here on the Gold Coast, and they came in and, you know, they need a whole new renovation side of things done. So they're putting in a second story. So we pretty much provided RMH to go in there and do the whole fit out. And then they need a custom, they're pretty much rebranding. They need a custom check-in process and process for people to order packages online and come in and do shoots and stuff like that. So Alphabyte's building their whole software and UX Flow's doing their whole website. So you end up with a lot of these businesses as well, because there's an internal ecosystem. When somebody approaches UX Flow, it needs a website, but they also need a custom JavaScript app done and integrations. And he can be like, oh, and you know, we can actually put those two together and offer a single package. So it does make the offering more powerful, because you can take these different entities and kind of they all feed off of each other, as far as, you know, every business needs accounting and every business needs a website and every business needs that. And so, like you said, we've kind of created these things. But the people that we have running these, because people often ask me, they're like, how do you sleep at night? Because they see the McClellan Hill entity and they're like, you know, the headache that comes along with running one business minus. But we really let the person that's the main director, Sean and I are directors of all the companies as well, but we really let the person that we have brought in and partnered with kind of run the show. And so I'm not taking home the headache of, you know, running the fabrication shop every night, but you know, he's got Sean and I to lean on whenever he says, all right, like we need to hire an extra guy, or we're having this complication, or these guys aren't paying us. You know, we have a group of lawyers in Brisbane that we use, and, you know, so we're able to kind of sit there and help. You know, he doesn't bear the weight of everything. He bears the weight of making sure that the business is running and like the product's getting out and that the quality assurance is the way that it should, but in that people are getting a good experience. But all that other nonsense that comes along with running a business that people don't realize until they get into it, we're there. I mean, we meet with every single director, you know, once a week or once a fortnight and do a full cash flow projection. What do you have coming in? What are your expenses? I have spreadsheets. We do BAS reports, set that money aside, pay YG reports, set that money aside. And so there's all that, I guess, trial and error that we've learned, which are the pain points of, you know, growing a business and are the reason most businesses go out of business. And we keep that stuff from happening by being there. And they hate that stuff. They hate the accounting side. They hate the money side. They hate all of it. But they don't really have to bear that. We kind of just have them come in and work stuff through. And you know, make sure that everything's on the right trajectory. And if there are any issues, then we can come up with, you know, so a lot of people sometimes will have meetings with people and we'll say, all right, well, you know, give us 50% of your company and we'll, you know, bring all this alongside and, you know, give this amount of cash and everything else. And people are so like, oh, you know, I don't want to give up my baby or give up any of this stuff. And what they don't realize, you know, 90% of the time, if not more, you know, they're going to own 100% of nothing versus 50% of something that's very successful, because, you know, having three heads working on something versus one head working on something, having all those resources and stuff around you is just priceless.
It is. It really is. You know, I've had a few guys at businesses and over probably 10 years. And it's taken me 10 years to figure it out.
Mm.
Yeah. And I still don't have it figured out, you know. Mm. But I'm miles ahead of where I was 10 years ago. Well, maybe even, 10, 11, 12 years ago.
Mm.
When, you know, I read a book, which gave me the concept, the idea to create my first business.
Yep.
The business didn't necessarily fail. It's just that I had no fucking idea what I was doing. Right.
Yeah.
And, two and three different iterations of that. Now 10 years later, now I understand it so much more. So what I'm feeling from what you're saying is pretty much you're going to instantly get even more advanced than that.
You get a decade. You get a decade under your belt instantaneously. Straight away. And so you don't
with other people to do it for you as well. That's the other critical thing, right?
Yeah.
Because you said before, you know, you got to realize that you're not starting a business that you can't work full-time on the tools.
Yep.
You can't work full time because you have to do marketing and this and that. But it's not that you can't work full time. It's that you have to work three or four or five full time jobs.
Correct.
And so the image you're giving me now is fucking attractive.
Mm.
For someone who, you know, doesn't want to waste time on that journey that you have to go through. There's no other way to learn it.
Yeah.
You know you can do an MBA and that sort of stuff, but you're still going to come out and be a graduate in the company somewhere. You have to learn these things hands on.
And even, you know, you watch shows like Shark Tank or whatever, and they come in and, you know, give away 95% of their company. And, you know, I mean, that's an extreme case, but normally that's where it ends up down the line. And you wonder how in the world could this guy only keep 5% of his company? And it's like, well, the people that he sold off to and the people that bought into the company and the people that he gave shares to and all that, they got his product into every retail shop across America. So now the company is worth $300 million.
It was worth $300,000 before.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So 5% of 300 million is well and truly more than 100% of 300,000. And people, for some reason, you know, I think people just feel like they're going to lose control of their company. And it's generally not the case. It's, you know, and you know, if you're good at coming up with ideas and you have a lot of business ideas, you don't really need to latch on to one of them specifically, you know, to this day and age, because like you said, the market's changed so quickly and everything's shifting. You know, you're better off to get in and out and have an exit plan and build a company up and sell it off and move on with life than you are to watch, you know, what you built from scratch slowly die over 7 years because the industry shifts and changes and new technology comes out and you become, you know, obsolete and outdated. So,
yeah.
And that's mainly kind of around products rather than services. But
well, you also get eaten up too. You know, you've got in professional services, you see a lot of mergers and acquisitions take place. And, you know, that's sometimes good for smaller operators because the bigger you get, the less focused on smaller on your client outcomes you can be.
Yeah.
So there's always a market, but you may get swallowed up. You may get left behind because you just don't have these resources of big businesses. So that happens in professional services all the time.
Okay. Yeah. It's and a lot of the times it's about being at the right place at the right time when you start a business, you know, and sometimes, you know, that wave rides into shore and then crashes and, you know, you gotta move on. But, what we've, you know, I mean, some of this stuff is planned and some of it wasn't, but it just naturally came. And it's about partnering with the right people. You know, we don't just, you know, pick up anybody off the street, obviously, but when you get with somebody and you know that they're the best in their class and you know that they really know what they're doing and they're actually looking to fix issues in that industry and really bring a good solution that's going to be high quality, and actually they're not just looking to pretty much get a payday and, you know, whatever, then we want to partner with them because they're actually they're destined to be successful. Mm-hmm. But there's so many hindrances in the marketplace with starting a business and growing a business, you know, everywhere, but specifically Australia. And so having all that extra, you know, support and the ability to inject capital to get past certain speed humps and, like you said, bring all that knowledge and skill sets to where they get to keep focus. It's the best of every world. Everybody wins because they get to focus on what gets them up in the morning and what actually really brings them joy. And they get to kind of offshore all of that, not offshore, but they get to offload all of that, stuff that is really, all the minutiae that they normally would have to wade through that they really don't have any cares for.
Yeah. And not just care, no cares for, but time, you know, I'll give an example of a recent thing that I've gone through, which is I subscribe to SEM Rush to get some marketing analytics and things done, you know, cause that's something I want to look at these days.
Yep.
And, not only did I not really have the time to even look at it, I don't have the time to learn a whole new skill either to understand what I'm even reading.
Yeah.
And so I contacted these guys and said, look, I'm canceling this because it was just a month-by-month thing. There was no issues. But I just said, look, it's I don't have the time, the capability to even understand what your platform's telling me, let alone use it, learn how to use it.
Yep.
That's what I mean. Going back to what we were saying before, the concepts you present is you know, for someone who hasn't gone through the path and know exactly what it is that you present, it'd be difficult for them to kind of comprehend. But if you know that, it's a valuable concept.
Yeah.
And
it's a lot more of a competitive world out there now. Back in the day when the internet was, you know, even 7-8 years ago, if you had a little bit of SEO knowledge or could throw a website together, it could do whatever, you were already kind of in front of the pack. But nowadays, because there's so many website builders and there's so many SEO, you know, it takes a lot more to get, you know, not on page 10 of Google, but on page one of Google. I mean, everyone knows if you're not in the first 5 spots.
Yeah, that's right.
You might as well not even be there.
And this takes it back to a very, very beginning comments with this, because you're also going to compete with AI now as well.
Correct.
Good fucking luck.
Yeah.
I can't, you know, not in areas I'm very well equipped and skilled in. Today I'll still beat AI, I think.
Yep.
I don't know for how much longer, but I'll still beat AI. Everything else.
Well, we wrote a script probably 4 weeks ago to scrape the ATO website, which is like 63,000 pages. So it turns all of the ATO website into pretty much documents instead of HTML text and everything. So it pulls out all of the actual text. And then we run that through an AI engine. Mm. And so we have a ChatGPT agent, which is specifically trained on the ATO. So and it refreshes every like 24 hours or something like that. So as soon as they bring anything out, if there's anything that's applicable to any of our businesses, or if we have any questions around compliance, you know, and that kind of stuff, or incentives that they're rolling out for the new fiscal year, we just talk to it and it knows. It's a sad fact, but unfortunately, similar to Blockbuster, Netflix kind of comparison, you know, if people don't pivot and utilize it, and I hate AI, like, you know. But I know from a business standpoint, as running businesses, if I don't utilize it, then I'm going to get left behind because other businesses that I'm in competition with are going to be utilizing it, which is going to make them more efficient, more cost effective, cheaper, better service, better, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so.
And these pressures that you're talking about right now, this is what I mean when I say governments have no right to tell you how you must run your workplace.
Yep.
Because they don't know. They don't compete. They have no competitor that can take them out of the market at any day now. Not just competitors, but technology, or new ideas, all sort of stuff. They collect money. They don't make it. There's no pressure on their shoulders at all.
Yep.
You know, it takes us full circle back to that point, I think, that you know, all these things we're talking about here, employees don't get it. They don't understand. These are the pressures that business owners have to actually live with every day and go to sleep at every night thinking about trying to stay ahead of it all to keep you paid, to keep you food on your table, to keep your family fed, not just their own, you know.
And most business owners, not only do they have those pressures, they also have the subconscious and subliminal pressures of the tall poppy syndrome of not wanting to look successful. Oh, they feel guilty rolling up in their brand new whatever because they know the employees are going to say, you know, well, you do this and you go play golf on this Friday and you do this and you do, you know, and they don't have any paradigm or understanding of how much blood, sweat, and tears and sacrifice went into build that business and how much risk is associated with running that business. And so, you know, not only do they have all of that pressure that they take home with them, but then also for the most part, the majority of people then feel guilty to even have success once they do achieve it because they feel like everyone around them is judging them.
That's a real phenomenon. Absolutely happens. You know, I've recently bought a new car for the company.
Yeah.
And, you know, for 2 years, you know, really spent nothing for two years to make sure the company was safe, secure, and stable, and lots of stuff. And even with that purchase, as a company purchase, it's for the sake of the company.
Yeah.
I'm still worried about turning up on a client's site and they see your new car and they're like, oh, that's what I'm paying for, is it?
100%.
You know, I'm like, well, come on, you know, that's real too, you know. Yep. So, yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it? We've been going a while now. How are you going for time? Hour and 10. I better get back on your day. But before that, though, a question if you can answer it, you know, technology aside, skill set aside, let's say you need to find someone for your business.
Yep.
Recruitment, trying to find the right person. I have this conversation with no shit every one of my clients.
Okay.
Everybody's looking for people.
Yep.
You know, it's not that you can't find someone. It's that you can't find someone that's right for the role without actually throwing buckets of cash at them and that sort of thing, right? That aside, let's say, for example, you're looking for someone in any of your businesses and skill set, they match it. The remuneration's right. They match that. There's no worries there. Technology, they understand all that. There's no concerns about that.
Yep.
What's left over that's going to make you go, yeah, they're the right person? What sort of things is what do you think you're looking for in today's employee market?
Well, yeah, I don't know how much I can say here, but I think this is a pretty open spot. I am about probably the least non-woke individual that you'll ever encounter, you know, or in the
least woke or least non-woke?
Least woke. and so that actually is a large indicator of people that I want associated with us or on our team. As sad as that is, because we're entering, I think, with that whole sense of entitlement, a lot of that propaganda and that brainwashing that's taking place with the mind virus, as Elon would call it. They generally are all in the same camp as far as the same way of thinking, kind of, you know, very victim mentality, woe is me type of standpoint. And so generally speaking, I want those people as far away from me as possible, not because I have anything against them, but just because of the trouble that will naturally come out of that situation, especially because of the things I say around the office and people not understanding who I am or my heart will, you know, potentially either take it wrong or become offended or something of that nature. So, in saying that, you know, if they have all the right things, generally speaking, because so much of our group is close knit and very kind of family oriented, you kind of can feel right off the bat whether somebody vibes or not, or whether somebody fits. So it's definitely a lot more than, because anybody can be trained on anything. Like what you said, most of the people that come out of uni and stuff are well and truly behind the times in whatever field it is that they're in. And so it's really about people being teachable and being coachable and having a good work mindset and skill set as far as, you know, willing to kind of, you know, lay down their pride and put in the hard yards and do whatever it takes to get that knowledge to be good. And, you know, most of that stuff can be trained and learned off YouTube and whatever else. And so Yeah, skill sets are important, but generally attitude and kind of work ethic are, you know, really the most two primary things that we look for. Everything else, you know, kind of comes on the back end of those. And then, yeah, obviously them, you know, we don't have an HR department because I would be the first one fired, you know, if it was a traditional, if it was a traditional
HR, yeah. Corporate HR teams. Absolutely. I would be too. Don't worry about that.
Exactly.
I understand what you're saying there. You know, it's a comment I'll make based on your point there. You know, I was asked, I won't say who asked me this question, but we've got clients who have been approached by people that said, oh, look, I want to be an intern for you.
Yeah.
Don't pay me. I just want to get exposure. I just want to be, you know, around your brand and that sort of thing. Turns out the internship couldn't happen because through the university she'd already done one, so she came back and said, give me a volunteer contract instead. Right. And the question was asked, why would someone volunteer? Why would they even do that? And I'm like, my response was, because of that question you just asked, because no one's going to do it.
Yep. Right.
Now, you mentioned then someone sort of work ethic, going above and beyond, doing more. And when I was younger, I'm 42 years old. I'm not that old. You know, I started working at a very young age. I left, you know, probably about 13, 14 years old. I was working in full-time work.
Yep.
No skills, no family support.
Yep.
No money. I had to take what I could get. I mean, I had strong visions for myself, even at that age, that I wasn't going to, you know, be washing cars for my life. If that's what will get you somewhere.
Correct.
Your degree won't.
Yep.
It's not worth much.
Yep.
If you will willingly do more than the others will, you're going to get all the opportunities come your way that you want.
Yep.
There's no doubt in my mind about that. Unless you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that, you know, that's a bit different because you have to have the ticket. But, you know, that today, it's crazy that, you know, people are just so hell-bent on, I'm not getting out of bed unless you give me what I want. Why should they?
Yeah.
Like, why should they? You need the opportunities in life. You need the career. You need the future. They've already got it.
Yep.
Right? So, good points you raise, and I agree 100%. Let's wrap it up.
Yeah.
Let's give it a kick in the guts and court. Cool, into it. Thanks for coming along and joining us. Appreciate that. Your website, what is it?
So the company group is mcclellanhill.com, and you can get to any of the other businesses from there.
Beautiful, mcclellanhill.com. Check it out. Thanks for joining me, and for everyone else listening, there's a usual sign off we do, which is until next time, keep a tight workplace, and we'll talk soon.